You probably worked out we had a couple of technical problems there. We're just going to turn down my computer, which if you just shut it, Joe, that will be fine. Just close it and it'll go. Welcome to the seventh of our Teneo Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. On the day our Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his fiancée Carrie Symons announced the birth of a baby boy. So far, the debate on health versus wealth has been heavily weighted towards ensuring our hospitals, doctors, nurses, and their support staff are protected. But as the weeks have passed, there's been more pressure to ease up and to open up and to protect the economy more. The problem for the government is two things are true: relax the lockdown too early, and we face a potentially devastating second spike; continue the lockdown for too long, and there's lasting damage to the economy. We're going to discuss that and so much more with an amazing panel of guests today. They are Nicola Mendelsohn, the Facebook Vice President for EMEA, who's going to talk about how the billions of people who are using Facebook are reacting, and also how she is leading the business through this time. Alex Baldock, the CEO of Dixons Carphone, will talk about digital transformation and how COVID-19 is accelerating that process. Frances O'Grady is a General Secretary of the TUC. She'll talk about the impact of COVID-19 on employees and how she thinks unions and managers can work together. And Amber Rudd, a regular on this call, is a Teneo Senior Advisor and former Home Secretary. She'll analyse the political situation in the UK and abroad. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right of the screen, you can see the chat function, and please put some questions in there, and we'll put them to the panel as we get into the second half of the call. And just to say, for legal reasons, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. We aren't intending to use this for broadcast or publication in any way, and it's under Chatham House rules. So that's done. Let's get to it and start with Nicola Mendelsohn. We'll start with you. You're not only operating as a business, but seeing directly how COVID-19 is affecting the way people interact. What can you tell us about running a business at this time and seeing how things have changed, Nicola?
So, hello everybody. It's great to be on the call with you all today. I don't think there's a business anywhere that hasn't had to change things or act in a different way. And at the heart of it starts with people. Even those that are the most entitled and have the most are still feeling pain and angst in different ways. And I think it's important just to acknowledge that. So the most important thing to everyone on the call, I hope you are well, and I hope your families are well. For us, from a Facebook perspective, we've really shifted into three key areas that we've been addressing at the moment. The first is making sure that people have access to accurate information and at the same time taking off misinformation. To be there for businesses to help them through this time, both on the health and the economic recovery. Very important to us that we can play our role there. And then thirdly, making sure at the heart of everything that we do across the Facebook platforms that we're actually able to keep people connected in this unprecedented time, a word oft overused, and we definitely need some more words that sum up that at this time, but how we can make sure that we keep our infrastructure in place and see the different ways that people are actually connecting at this time. So just to take some of those and then also then how you actually lead from a human perspective, what it actually means to be a leader when you have people scattered across many different countries and everybody's working with some of their confines from home. And actually, I love the start of the call by going, actually, I would like a baked potato with jacket and cheese as well, because it's human, isn't it, to have the child come in. I don't think any kind of business people that have got, living in homes with other people have probably had that moment. I certainly have. One of my children interrupted a very important call whereby just to tell me his homework was nearly done, hadn't even been done, but was nearly done. So anyway, taking each of those in turn, briefly, what have we done and how have we pivoted? We put at the top of everybody's news feeds in almost every country now in which we operate, information that is accurate from organizations. We partner very closely with the World Health Organization, both in giving them money to help through this time, but actually making sure that the accurate information from them is getting out to people in the world. So we've done that at the tops of the news feed on both Facebook and Instagram, but also through creation of a WhatsApp chatbot that people can get accurate information. That's really important. We've really prioritized making sure that through all the learnings we've had in recent years, that we're getting misinformation off our platform. And we're constantly reviewing what misinformation means. And it doesn't matter where that misinformation comes from, we don't want it on our platforms. On the economic side, on the economic side, one of the things that we've really been focused on is how we can help small businesses. So we announced a $100 million grant that we'll be going to be giving out to about 30,000 small businesses around the world across multiple countries, which we're doing at the moment. We've started in the US, but also crucially, how we've changed some of the resources, the webinars that we're able to give companies, small businesses, to help them shift to digital, to help them understand how they can reach customers. And we've seen a huge number of pivots at this time and in that area. On the health side, our focus has been on the creation of a symptom survey whereby people can actually declare whether if they've got any of the early symptoms of COVID. And we've been doing that with Carnegie Mellon in the US. And we've used these types of maps before. It's all anonymized data to actually predict patterns of behavior. And again, that can help governments and local authorities start to see where hotspots might be re-emerging, and especially as we move out of lockdown and re-emerge out. This is a really important piece of information to help in that planning. And then finally, on the connection side, one, making sure that our infrastructure it stands in place, but more that we're actually able that people can connect in the most extraordinary ways, whether it's the Clap for the Carers in the UK that started on a WhatsApp group, or it's the extraordinary number of groups and WhatsApp groups, Facebook and WhatsApp, that have been set up in local areas in order to help people to connect. And then from a business perspective, how I'm thinking about this and in terms of how I'm leading at this time, it's all about people first. Every day that I'm thinking about the person that's probably in the most challenged way that's working for us, that maybe is in a one-bedroom room, has poor access to internet, and probably maybe lives in a different country, feels quite isolated, maybe is thinking about somebody that's not well. I try and tread in those shoes, and then everything comes from there. So we've been quite lucky as a company in as much as that we had a lot of the tools able to be able to work remotely, and people were very used to seeing each other on video calls like this, BlueJeans, Zoom calls. That was pretty normal for us. But also it's been a real adjustment for us because not everybody that worked with us did have that understanding of how to do it. So that's been a pivot. But we've also seen some great moments of people coming together. So whether it's been yoga classes that have been set up, whether it's been fundraising activities that people have done, virtual Olympics. One of my favorites is coffee roulette, where at the start of every week you can put your name in a hat and you get allocated a Zoom number where you just turn up and you see three or four other people for 20 minutes and you have a break. Because that's the thing that people miss. They miss those moments when people can come together and can come to connect. And the wonderful thing about technology is it is allowing us to connect together at this time. So that's just some of the things that we're thinking about. But crucially, as we start to re-emerge, how we cement some of the new skills that we're all learning and make sure that we can apply those going forward as well.
Nicola, thanks for that. That was great. I'm just looking at the chat function and I'm seeing some orders for baked potato and cheese coming through. But we'd also quite like some questions too. So Alex Baldock, let's go to you next. Carphone Warehouse has had to go from being a bricks and mortar and online business to essentially an online business in just a few short weeks. How's that been for you?
Yes, and that's been true, Craig, for Carphone Warehouse, also for Currys PC World, our mainstream UK brand. We've effectively had a crash course in becoming an online pure play. I mean, digital was always important for us, but as you point out, it's become everything in the UK over the past 5 weeks. So on the one hand, we've been pleased by the amount of store sales that we've been able to recover, and slightly surprised on the upside that we've been able to take two-thirds of the lost store sales and recover them online, which is what we announced this morning, which is in one level good. And it also shows, to echo Nicola's point, I think the big difference that longer standing colleagues of ours noticed between this crisis and the last big shock of 2008 to 2009 is how much bigger a role technology plays in people's lives. So we're seeing the customer demand, and I'm getting the letters from customers saying how much they appreciate being kept connected with their loved ones when they're locked down, stay healthy, being able to cook and cook for their families and keep their families fed, stay productive, whether it's working from home or homeschooling the kids, as well as entertained when they're locked down with the kids for 5 weeks. They're pretty grateful for the gaming options that we can provide. And I think a lot of that accounts for the very big jump in online sales that we've seen. We've had to learn quite a lot as we've been doing it, how we generate demand. Nicola will be pleased to hear that we've moved on quite a lot in our thoughts on social and digital marketing over the past 5 weeks. We've learned a lot about PPC and how to use it and how not. I think we've also learned a lot about supply and worked really well with suppliers like everyone from Microsoft to Google to HP to Apple and the like, in making sure that we're able to meet this unexpected peak level, Black Friday level set of demands and a changing shape of demands for product and still be able to make that available for customers. Capacity has also been severely challenged. Again, we've got peak levels of demand more or less overnight without having done all the peak trading levels of preparedness that we would usually do for Christmas. So we had to learn all of that. So all of this in pretty short order, learning how to play this bigger role in customers' lives that we're able to do. I think the second thing, and maybe this touches a bit onto what Francis is going to come on to talk about a little bit later, we've only been able to do this because we've been able to persuade our colleagues that we're keeping them safe. And we're asking a number of people to leave their homes to come to work at the moment. Our delivery drivers and our colleagues in the warehouses, they can't work at home. And if we're going to ask them to come to work, we have to show them that we're doing everything that we conceivably can to keep them safe. And we've learned lightning quick about social distancing and hygiene standards and one-way systems and tannoy reminders and floor markings and hi-vis and all as well as all the sanitizing kit and standards that we've set in all of our warehouses and elsewhere in the supply chain. We've learned that in double quick time to give our colleagues the confidence to keep coming to work, and so we can look ourselves in the mirror that we're doing this responsibly. It's also sparked quite a lot of innovation. And perhaps we're not as swift off the mark as organizations like Facebook historically. We haven't been when it comes to innovating. And I think we found out a few things about our own innovative muscle when we've needed it, and starting to think about blurring the boundaries between the analog and the digital in some quite interesting ways. This week, for example, we launched Shop Live, which is how to bring the best of our bricks and mortar retailing experience to online customers by having colleagues who would otherwise be on furlough live but via video helping customers shop on the when they're on the website, and therefore helping customers and also making the most of some assets that we've got that an online pure play hasn't got, the expert colleagues. And that's one of half a dozen innovations that we've seen across the group maybe take hold a lot quicker than they would ordinarily do. And I suppose that then brings us to raising our gaze beyond this crisis. And what we're seeing is some changes in consumer behavior, and we're having to ask ourselves the question, how much of that's going to stick? So many of particularly older customers have become experts in video conferencing in the last 5 weeks, whereas previously they never used it in their lives. People are starting to get used to telemedicine and maybe won't be making so many visits to the GP in the future. And of course, we've seen this massive spike in online sales, and some of that new behavior is going to stick. And for those of us with a significant analog part to our business, in our case, it's bricks and mortar retail, I think many of us are having to ask ourselves some quite hard questions about our business model going forward and how we're going to make, in our case, omnichannel retail relevant in this new environment where customers have had this spike in their digital-first mindset that's going to endure. Quite apart from the fact of other considerations like how we account for lingering social distancing, which we expect to last well beyond the point when the government starts to ease the lockdown, people are going to become are going to stay quite chary of physical proximity with others. So how we accommodate that for, in our case, in stores with the contact zero contact store model that we're developing and having ready for when the government gives the green light. And then there's the small matter of a recession on the way and the effect on discretionary income that that's going to have. So all of that, I suppose you could wrap up as this forced digital first experiment that we've been under for the past 5 weeks. We've learned a lot on how to serve customers. And we've also learned, perhaps not as much as Facebook have, but we've learned something about how to run our own business. And to give you, I mean, one example, we're having this VC. I've lost count of the number of VCs that I've had with my teams spread all over the place and suppliers spread all over the world over the past 12 weeks, the past 6 weeks, and we're going to be a very different business going forward, with much more leaner, agile, faster moving ways of working, much more tolerance towards flexible working and remote working, and a more skeptical attitude towards the travel bill, to name but one part of our business that we expect to be rather different going forward. So in short, Craig, a forced digital first experiment that we expect to see lasting effects from, both in terms of how we serve our customers and our own business.
Thank you, Alex. That was fascinating. Francis, I'm going to come to you next. The TUC represents tens of millions of workers. Tell us about your hopes and fears for them going forward.
Well, one of my hopes is that we're seeing a change not just in behaviours. It's almost like we've got two new classes, isn't it? Those who can work from home and those who can't. But we're not just seeing a much greater use of digital technology to work and big challenges on that front. We're seeing, I think, a fundamental shift in values, because what I hear is people recognizing that some of the most important jobs in society are paid least. Many more people have learned that sick pay, statutory sick pay, is just £95 a week, and that's pretty tough to live on. But there are millions who don't even earn enough to qualify for that, particularly in the gig economy. And of course, universal credit, and having helped a family member apply for it, I can tell you that is like a full-time job in itself. So many more people have been exposed to what the world is like, what's happened to our social protection system, the kinds of jobs that people are doing to keep Britain going and being often rewarded very little for. And that, you know, it can't just be a case anymore of us looking after our families. We have to look after our workmates and neighbours too. So I wonder whether there is a kind of an appetite for a different kind of set of values that really show how dependent we are on each other. I think from the TUC's perspective, I have to say I kind of reject this pitting our human health versus economic health, because it seems to me that that takes us on a road to nowhere. We need both. We're at the beginning of a transition to trying to get our economy back off its knees. I think many of us recognize that, you know, unemployment and poverty hurt people's health too, but that critically we can get back to work, but it's got to be safe work. And from a TUC perspective, we've got loads of really good positive agreements with employers that show a bit of imagination and creativity in terms of staggered shifts, how we deal with catering, how people can get safely to work. And, you know, so it is possible to work that transition in a way that keeps people safe. But at the same time, we've had this terrible scandal on PPE, and the TUC has been calling for a public inquiry about how come we're sending health and care workers over the top to look after us all, but they're going to do that work without the proper kit and protective equipment. So our priorities have been around safety, around jobs and livelihoods. And what I think is kind of interesting is that in some parts of government, there's been a very different sort of relationship with the trade union movement. So with the Chancellor, we worked really closely to get the job retention scheme up and running, the first time Britain's ever had a wage subsidy scheme that not only puts money into workers' pockets, but also means that when we do recover, hopefully we'll be able to bounce back quicker because workers will still be connected to those companies. Finally, I would just like to kind of raise some questions about what happens next, because a lot of the big challenges that we're facing are not going to go away. We're still going to have to deal with climate change, technology, productivity, what's happened to the good work agenda, and what's happened to levelling up. So these are big challenges, and I think it would, I guess, a test of whether we are going to see a different approach is whether unions alongside business are invited in to sit around the table with government to start planning. One of my biggest worries is that we are going to see pretty large scale unemployment resulting from this crisis. And particularly for young people, we know that can have a really scarring effect. So why don't we get our heads together and start planning now for quality jobs and skills programs that will do right by the new generation of workers and help us to start rebuilding in a way that works for working people. I think I've lost you.
No, I think, yeah, if have we lost Craig, in which case I'll just proceed. Nicola, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I think we lost Craig, so why don't you carry on, Amber?
I am showing my leadership skills, Nicola, with your help, and I'm going to proceed. So the cabinet was, and the political class in Westminster was hugely relieved when the Prime Minister came back. We know, some of which Francis has set out, that government's going to need to make some pretty critical decisions over the next few days, few weeks, and they were really waiting for the Prime Minister to come back. He came back, and in his speech, he made an offer, really, to the fact that the ending of the lockdown, or the phased approach, he was going to be very cautious about, not surprisingly, a man who'd had such a near-death experience. But I thought most interestingly is he said he was going to engage with people, engage with businesses, engage with the public, which I feel is what people are really crying out for. And as we go into, we're going into PMQs today. This morning there was some concern about whether he was going to do PMQs. There was some early sniping about it. And then it was quite reasonably announced that he wouldn't be doing PMQs because his fiancée has just had a baby boy. So we could all celebrate that and agree that it was a reasonable reason to miss PMQs. So coming to this debate of health and wealth, and the fact that, as Francis pointed out, really, it's more muted, it's more subtle than just saying, if we have to choose between health and wealth, because as we've been hearing so much, and as the cabinet I know is so concerned about, the lockdown has pretty catastrophic health consequences as well. We've been hearing about the build-up of cancer patients who haven't been going. We've been hearing about the additional deaths that have been taking place, not COVID related, because people haven't been going to hospital. And we know that there is a growth in online crime, particularly nasty online grooming, and there's a significant growth in domestic abuse. Domestic abuse helplines are receiving 50% more calls. There are some studies which are showing that there have been additional deaths as a result of this. So there is real harm taking place if this continues, as well as, of course, the harm to the economy, which will lead to health harms as well. Because as one doctor was pointing out on the radio the other day, there is clearly going to be more money spent on the NHS going forward. If that is the case, we need to have a strong economy. So all these things play into each other in a way that will be really difficult for the cabinet to try and assess at the moment. The one area that they are all looking to is, of course, other neighbours, particularly European neighbours. And it is the case that journalists and commentators are very much holding the UK government to account based on what's going on in France, what's going on in Germany, what has taken place in New Zealand, a small country, but still remarkable success. But as in Europe, we see the unlocking of some of these lockdown implementations on communities, the UK government will be watching very carefully to see which works, which don't, and which ones allow people to return to work. They're very mindful of the fact that in order to get the economy back working, people need to go back to work, businesses need to start flourishing. And the fact is that if furloughing doesn't end at the end of June, the costs, which are already huge, will become even worse. Recent gilt auctions, government debt, have been twice oversubscribed. That is not going to be sustainable if the furloughing continues and the debt continues to be issued. So it's a very fine balance at the moment, not just health and wealth, but also investor confidence in the economy so that we can continue to issue those bonds. Just a further comment, if I may, on the reset that is taking place. Frances was asking quite reasonably about levelling up, and I agree with her about the inequalities that could be embedded further rather than addressed for our future. But this is a chance, and I hope that the government will take it, really address things which Boris has spoken about before, and embed those changes as we come out of it. And you know, he very much appreciates the war comparison. As we come out of this war, then I hope that we will be able to embed those changes, building, you know, a community fit for the future, trying to address inequality, and also addressing the green issues, which have been bubbling away for so long. The government passed its commitment in law to get to net zero by 2050. The opposition, now newly renewed, will want to hold them to account for how that is going to happen. There will be some fiscal stimulus, not just in the UK, but internationally, in order to get our economies back on their feet. And if we can green those, then we will be achieving stimulus we need and also sticking to our green targets. At the moment, we're seeing the UK and Germany host the St. Petersburg Dialogue, new initiative to try and focus on what we can do to green our infrastructure investment. So on an optimistic note, I hope that we can come out of this investing in green issues. It looks like European countries are going to do that. It looks like the UK is focusing that way. We'll see if they actually deliver, and hopefully addressing that levelling up agenda with a new enthusiasm. Because in the past, Conservative governments have always tried to address limiting the amount of spending, concerned always about the responsibility of the debt being issued to the new generation. I have to say, I think that is over for now. There is a total reset which is taking place in government where you are allowed to spend money. You are allowed to address how we get out of this. And hopefully that will be addressing the inequalities which are otherwise going to get better, worse, and also the need to green the infrastructure investment, which we can look forward to.
Well done for the panel for covering. You probably saw there was some Keystone Cops sort of activity going on in the background here as we try to deal with some technical problems, but I'm back. I'm Frances, I'm afraid I've heard, didn't hear the back half of you or the front half of you, Amber, but we are here. One of the themes that's come through in terms of this discussion is kind of rejection of the health versus wealth debate. But the reality is in government, they're having to make a decision about whether or not they are going to significantly relax this lockdown. I'm going to put all of the panel on the spot and start with that and say, to what degree would you like to see the lockdown relaxed and there to be much more free flow of the economy? So, Alex, why don't we start with you on that?
Well, I think the first responsibility lies with business and businesses like ours to demonstrate that we can operate safely if the lockdown is eased. So in our case, for example, we're developing the zero contact store that we'll have ready for next week. We're not agitating for the government to make a decision next week. That's their call, but we'll be ready should the lockdown ease. And that we've been fortunate there in having a large business in the Nordics where the stores have obviously remained open. So for the past 4 weeks, we've been developing this model in real life. And this is a model where customers can still get a big chunk of why they want to come to stores. They can get a big chunk of those benefits, whether it's the face-to-face advice, picking, collecting an online order, dropping off or picking up a repair, for example, but they can do it without coming within 2 meters of a colleague. And we've done all the plexiglass protection for tills. We've got the PPE for the colleagues, whether it's goggles or masks or gloves. We've got the sanitizers, we've got the standards, we've got the cleaning in place. And we've done all of this in the Nordics, and we'll be ready to go with that in the UK next week. So I think the first responsibility is ours. Demonstrate that we don't need to have this choice between health and wealth. We can get the economy back moving, but do it in a way that doesn't risk the public health gains of the lockdown.
Amber, how much would you like to see it relaxed?
I think it's got to start. I mean, we're already seeing signs that the public are making their own decisions, going out shopping, getting out more. And we're seeing, for instance, that I think the councils have announced that their tips are going to be open. It's, you know, it sounds trivial, but it's quite significant because people are doing so much at home and it'll stop fly tipping. But I think that the government have got to go with the grain. But I think Alex's point is very important. businesses and council departments, etc., have got to adjust to the new reality by putting social distancing in it. I think quite soon we'll flip to the other way, which is it's quite difficult to get people to come to work because they will be concerned about their own health. So working practices have already got to get into place so that as it relaxes, they come to a place where it is reasonable to expect they can socially distance.
And Francis, you must see this dilemma very clearly in terms of protecting workers, but also wanting them to be able to have jobs at the end of it.
Yeah, and let's not forget that millions of people are and have been at work throughout this. But all our polls show really strong anxiety. And I think it's easy to forget. We've got people who are for sure worried about their own health, but actually the key worry is what they might bring home. Lots of us are living with people who are vulnerable, maybe formally shielded, or we've got pregnant workers, people with various vulnerabilities who are really worried. And so that says to me that we have to really build people's confidence that risk is being taken seriously. And that's why we haven't called for a shutdown, but we have said that every workplace needs to have a robust risk assessment in place so that we get some of those good working practices that we've heard about. If people can continue to work at home, then why not? Let's transition this in a phased way. We can do split shifts. We can, you know, work in different ways. We are going to have to see a shift to that job retention scheme, so that we can allow for short-time working. I think that would help. But the key issue is people having the confidence that their safety is being taken seriously. And of course, when you look at what's happening in the health and social care system, there are lots of reasons to believe that that hasn't happened to the standard that people have a right to expect. And of course, by law, if people don't feel are being asked to work in unsafe conditions, they have a right to refuse to do so. So we need to see some tough enforcement. I mean, I'm fed up of getting reports from fast fashion warehouses where people are literally being crowded in to, you know, rubbing shoulders as they're at work. That's wrong, and it should be cracked down on now by the enforcement agencies, and the government should be giving a really clear message. And just one other point, clearly the scale and pace at which we shift is going to depend critically on what happens in our transport system, where there are some genuine difficulties about social distancing at work on a train, for example, and of course in schools. So, you know, there are lots of working parents who will find it really difficult to get back to work unless our schools are up and running. So we need to make a priority of making sure that they're safe too.
Nicola, where do you stand on this in terms of easing the lockdown?
At the risk of kind of being repeating what some people have already shared, the two are inextricably linked. You can't have health, you can't get your wealth without having a healthy nation. And so for companies that are able to work at home, I think they should, and they should be able to do that for longer. And if you like, ease the burden on those that have to work. I like Francis's speaking around the different classes, those that can and those that can't. And, you know, we're certainly seeing that. We were one of the companies that went very early on working from home, and we put very clear guidance in that regardless of where the countries start to open up, that we are still mandatory from home till at least the end of May. But also I think it's about thinking forward about what's going to happen in terms of without a vaccine, without a cure, this is going to last for a long time in different ways. And so how we can make sure that we can all help from a business perspective to ease that pressure. So it goes without question, and the risk of another peak occurring. And so things we've made rulings like no big events over 50 people for at least a year till June 2021. And so that means it can refocus people to think about if we used to do X event that brought together 200 people, don't waste the mindset on starting to plan something for 6-8 months time, which then might have to be pulled. Let's refocus on how we can do things virtually. And we've seen that creativity that Alex was talking about, that innovation, actually you can do a lot of things in different ways. But first and foremost, the absolute primary concern will remain the well-being of the people, but also what part we can play in helping to ensure that others can take the rides on the tube or others can take the bus, because they actually need to be physically present to do their job.
Sticking with you, Nicola, there's a couple of questions about misinformation. People saying they agree with you about trying to root it out. How is Facebook defining misinformation and who's making the judgments on that?
Yeah, okay. So really clear that before the crisis, we put some really clear guidelines, rules and investments into this whole area. So one of the key things is that if there's anything out there that could cause real physical harm. So imagine things like, well, drinking X could cure. We would just take that down. That's really clear. We take advice from the World Health Organization. We're working very closely with them. We take advice from fact checkers around the world. And as you can imagine, this is something that's almost changing on a daily basis. So misinformation would be things like claims of where the origins of the virus have come from. So there isn't any absolute proof on what it is or is it isn't. And so we would get independent fact checkers to look at it. If they then say that this is misinformation, those things we don't take down. We take down things that will cause real physical harm, that just comes off the platform. But where it's something that, you know, it could be an opinion, but it's largely misinformation, we will say that it's misinformation so that when people see that post, they see that very clearly. And here's what the data tells us, that when those posts then go out, 95% of people never bother to even look at it. So those are sorts of the things that we're looking at. And we've also been putting more money into the fact-checking industry because we think it is an important industry. And we think it is important that there are other places to go that can make these decisions, that it shouldn't be the responsibility of one company.
Yeah, some of that fact-checking has been against the President of the United States, I imagine. Alex, we've got one question for you. People are interested to know if you think that the new business model might deliver a positive message on the carbon footprint of the combined organisations, or is it too early to give any thought on that, Alex?
It's pretty early, but I think, I mean, if you look at some of the things I've talked about our business, we spend an enormous amount of money every year on travel. But to give one example, just going to see suppliers all over the world, as well as travelling around the UK. I don't know what the travel bill for the next financial year is going to be, but it's going to be a lot lower than last, because we've discovered the power actually of digital technology to connect people. I'm having better, more frequent conversations with the chief executives of suppliers now than I did when I was getting on a plane and traipsing over to LA or to Seoul to go and see them. And so we're going to see a lot more of digital, remote, flexible working, which obviously has a significant sustainability benefit. When it comes to our business, I think that if what we're doing is we're helping millions of people stay at home throughout this crisis, and beyond it, if we're helping millions of people work from home, if there's a trend towards increased homeschooling that outlasts this crisis, we're the ones enabling that, as well as the basics of our business model. Our business model is not just to help customers walk out of a store or a site with a bit of kit. We're there to help them get the most out of that kit throughout its life. And we're the biggest technology recycler in Europe at the end of life. We offer attractive trade-in and upgrade offers to all of our customers to help them renew their technology. And then we dispose of the old kit responsibly. So I think that on the basis of what we believe is a pretty sustainable business model today, there are opportunities for this for what comes out of this crisis to accelerate that. Yes.
Thank you, Alex. There's a question here for Amber from Yvonne Hills, who's saying, what concerns should governments and the rest of us have over increased nationalism in the next months, years? Will the instincts of voters be to shut down and close borders, that kind of thing, going forward?
Well, I think it is a concern. You know, you saw a sort of hint of that when there was various fights going on about who had got what PPE from where, whether one country had exported it to another when they shouldn't have. So I think it is something we should be aware of. It's sort of heightened, isn't it, by the talk about China and about China being responsible, whether China will allow an independent investigation, and by the language, of course, that Donald Trump uses. I mean, the nationalism that comes with America first, really, and I'm afraid it does infect other countries. The best way, perhaps, for us not to continue down that road would be having better US leadership. At the moment, with Donald Trump at the helm, I fear that there is a move towards nationalism in a lot of countries. And in Europe, of course, you can see it in Hungary, where Orban has taken additional powers. So I think everybody should be alert to it. Yes.
Okay, one from Alice Hunt for Francis. Ensuring workers' voices are heard coming out of this crisis will be essential. Are you concerned that the debate will be dominated by the men at the fore of the three major trade unions and, by extension, their political and power-based agendas? And how would you like to see government engage with these unions?
I should say the trade union movement membership is now majority women, so we're a very different movement, I think, to the one we were 50 years ago. But for sure, the only way I think we're going to build confidence in a return to work is if working people do get a voice. And as I say, I think there are these bigger questions we have to address. Nobody can be confident that the virus is going to disappear overnight or not come back. So we're still going to have to concentrate on issues like testing and tracing, including at work. So my kind of call really is for a National Council for Recovery. I think it's an opportunity to get different voices around the table and a different kind of leadership to address those big issues about how do we ensure that we level up, cut carbon, create good work, and let's start planning for the future now. And I would just add, you know, I think there is a big contrast to how after the financial crash, you know, this isn't about being part of the Gordon Brown fan club, but I think Gordon Brown played a pretty important role globally in kind of marshalling countries towards a global response to that crash. And we can all have our critiques of it. I would have liked a bit more conditionality in there in terms of people getting money, people not getting blank checks. But there was a sense of global leadership. This time, it feels like, frankly, from my perspective, global leadership has been woeful. And we know why that is. But I think it's profoundly dangerous to retreat into a kind of national nostalgia at the very time when we need international cooperation, including on PPE and ventilators. How crazy it is for countries to be competing against each other instead of trying to share in a sensible sequence important protective equipment and lessons from this crisis so that we get the global economy back on its feet too.
Amber, I think you wanted to come in very quickly there.
Yes, just briefly, really, to endorse what Francis was saying about leadership. And even before this crisis, I think the biggest foreign policy challenge we were facing is the disputes between the US and China. And that this has just put a real heater underneath that, which is very damaging and potentially dangerous.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. There's a question here from Laura Flynn for you, Nicola. Great to hear that Facebook is supporting SMEs. I'd be interested to hear how Facebook is supporting UK news publishers who perform a critical role in scrutinising government's plans during the time when their future is increasingly under threat, given the significant fall in advertising spend.
Yeah, so I would absolutely agree that it's, you know, the news industry has never been, it's always been important, it's never been more important at the moment. So one of the things that we're doing is that we announced 2-3 weeks ago, I think it was now, that we were going to be putting $100 million globally into the news industry, into publishing. And that's a combination, one of supporting journalists, especially at a local news level, because one of the things that we're seeing at the moment is the importance of local communities, the importance of making sure that you can get news directed really at a local level, it matters. But also on from an advertising support to make sure that we've created a new fund to be able to spend new dollars, new pounds at this time as well, of which the UK absolutely industry will be a beneficiary of. So as well as all the ongoing things that we do with the news publishing industry as well.
We've got a question here from Alexander Aylman, who wants all the panel to respond very quickly. Lockdown has cleared the streets of cars, pollution has dropped. When the lockdown eases, isn't there a risk that people will feel they can only safely travel by car, reject public transport? Or if so, shouldn't national government be taking preventative action to curb this outcome? Let's start with you, Amber.
I don't think that'll be people's response, actually. I think people are talking about and enjoying the fact that they are welcoming the fact that there are less cars in the roads. I think it's incumbent on public transport to do more to make sure that people can use it. But the other thing I would say is following up on Alex's point on business, one business leader I spoke to said that they have got 1,500 people arriving in central London. They're going to stagger when they're expected, so they won't all have to come on public transport at the same time. So I hope it'll lead to different working practices so that people can social distance and come in at non-rush hour times when a lot of those public transport facilities are empty.
Alex?
Yes, to echo what you've just heard from Amber, we are already practicing much more flexible working and much more remote working, and that's going to continue beyond this crisis. Francis also talked about the importance of staggered shifts in places like warehouses and distribution centres for safety reasons, and that's going to endure for us beyond this crisis as well. But obviously there's a sustainability prize attached to that too. So I think the combination of us being much more conscious of how much work can be done remotely, how much work can be done without clogging up the roads and causing pollution, but also the fact that being much more flexible for those people who do have to leave their homes and come to work, much more flexible on shift patterns, and the staggering of those shifts will have a sustainability prize as well.
Francis, your view on this?
One of the kind of silver linings of this crisis has been proving that we can build massive hospitals in a matter of days. We can switch manufacturing production to socially useful things like protective equipment and ventilators. There has been extraordinary action from many individual companies and their workforces. So I wonder whether we can capture some of that same spirit, that if we can kind of deal with this virus with that sense of urgency, can we deal with climate change with the same sense of urgency and creativity too, and make those fundamental shifts to investment in good green public transport, not forgetting that, as we saw with the testing facilities, many care workers don't have cars. There are lots of people in this country who already depend on public transport, but can we make that the new normal for most of us?
And Nicola, are you noticing people's changing attitudes towards environmental issues and that kind of thing online, or is it still as strong as ever?
Yeah, I think, yes, we do see that. We saw that before. I think there was already a great movement that was forming around the world, and I think it is accelerating. Although there is also, I have seen research that does say that people are seriously considering buying cars for the first time when they hadn't, because of the way that they may need to get ahead in the future and to travel, especially for those that may be classed as vulnerable or live with someone that's vulnerable. So there are different mindsets around this one. So it's not black and white. It never was. It is complicated, but I do think we'll come out of this. You only have to look at the sky. It is a different color than it was before. It is quite different. You do hear the birds. And so there are lots of clues around, and I think some of the behaviors will be enforced after. People will want them to be. They'll enforce them themselves.
Okay, there's a few questions coming through about the furlough scheme and a lot of pressure on the government to increase it to 100%. And then also some voices coming out of the Treasury saying, look, this is simply unaffordable going forward. Where do we think the furlough scheme is going, and how much of a problem is it going to be if it's increased or indeed reduced? Amber, let's start with you on that.
So the furlough scheme is in place till the end of June and is costing much more than people expected. But I think there is some talk going on about instead of unwinding it all at once, it might be unwound in certain sectors over a period. One of the things that you can see about this government is that they moved quickly to put in place the COVID interruption loans, the grants to smaller companies, and the furlough scheme, which bought time. And then now, they, over the past few weeks, really, they've been adjusting them to make sure they work better. And that business bounce back loan that the Chancellor announced earlier in the week is exactly an example of that. So we've got these loans now coming in for micro businesses, really, and SMEs of 100%. I don't think he's going to move to 100% for the interruption loans, standing as they are 80%, although many of us prefer that he should have done that in order to give more support to businesses. But I think that on the furlough, they will unwind it at the end of June, depending on different sectors, because it's just not going to be feasible to unwind the whole thing at the end of June when all the businesses that they're focused on, particularly in the tourism sector, are not up and running. But I think we can be optimistic that the government has been responding to the changes that they are witnessing, having bought some time.
Alex, where are you on the furlough scheme?
Yeah, speaking as a retailer rather than just for Dixon's Car Firm, I think the first thing to say is that the government did act decisively and well in supporting retail through what would otherwise have been a disaster. The obviously retail accounts for 3 million private sector jobs. It's the biggest private sector employer. It pays a great deal of tax, and that we all know that bricks and mortar retail was under a fair amount of pressure from structural headwinds before this crisis. Now, had the furlough scheme in particular and tax holidays and deferrals like the rates holiday not been put in place, there would have been a bloodbath for employment and for tax revenue. Now, the government itself is now saying that we shouldn't expect the crisis to be over with a flick of a switch one day. It's going to take quite a long time to adjust to a new normal, and there are lots of different views about what that looks like. But one thing's for sure is it's going to take time for consumer confidence to return, time that's not going to be helped by the anticipated recession. So currently, as it stands, the government support, like the furlough scheme, ends at a cliff edge at the end of June. I don't think anyone that I talk to in retail is arguing for an extension of the furlough scheme to cover 100% of wages, but many people are arguing for, and our trade association, the BRC, is arguing for a tapering off of the benefits rather than them all coming off at the end of June as a cliff edge. Should they come off as a cliff edge, I do worry about the consequences for employment and for the tax take.
And Francis, you must be worried about the furlough scheme being reduced.
Yeah, I mean, Rishi Sunak deserves credit. He worked really closely, in fact, particularly with the TUC on the design of the scheme, but also with the CBI. And we've been in close contact ever since. And there have been improvements made ever since. But I think there are three big challenges. Firstly, we've got to get off this merry-go-round of redundancy notices being prepared with each slight extension. So we're on the four-week countdown. We know how destructive that can be to a business and how worrying that can be for workers when they get those notices through the post. Secondly, we do need that provision for short-time working, because where employers can afford to pay more of the wages, they should be, but they need the flexibility. We all need that flexibility, particularly for the transition period and particularly from a safety perspective. And finally, Alex is absolutely right. We need the scheme. We need to be planning now for a tapering of the scheme. So it's not just pulling the plug. We're actually planning how that is gradually wound down while still supporting jobs and livelihoods. You know, we've just had 12,000 redundancies at British Airways. The aviation industry is in meltdown. We are going to need to look at sectoral rescue packages as well. Otherwise, I'm really worried about what kind of economy we're going to emerge into. But again, I'd like to see some conditionality. If we're going to give public support to industries like aviation, then let's have some tough commitments on how we green that industry too.
Okay, look, we're coming to the end of the call, but I've got one more question for the panel I'd like 30 seconds from each of you on. Is one of the big themes that we've had throughout these calls is how COVID-19 has effectively accelerated trends that were already happening. We're almost being fast forwarded to the future. What are the things that you think you would like to see stay in terms of the changes that have happened because of COVID-19, and maybe some of the things that you'll hope will change for the better going forward? So, Nicola, let's start with you.
Well, obviously, I'm going to say digital. You know, I would say that we've seen, you know, an extraordinary way in which people are connecting in ways. But also with that, at the heart of that is the importance of community. And so how people now are rediscovering the fact that who their neighbours are, that people are helping out for one another and being there. And so actually that kindness that we've seen throughout all of this, that's the most important thing that I would like to see maintained.
Alex.
I'd echo Nicola's point on digital. I mean, whether we want it or not, it's going to happen. And that's one of the things that we need to get ready for. I mean, I was speaking to a customer the other day who's a gentleman in his 70s who's gone from being a digital novice to a digital master in the space of 5 short weeks. And his life is never going to be the same again. And we have many customers like them. And so, like it or not, we need to accommodate that. And now for us, it happens to suit us because we want to operate as a digital first omnichannel retailer. So that's fine. As far as the things that we would like to see less of, I mean, clearly there is a recession coming, and the sooner that is behind us and the less severely it affects us, clearly the better. But I think, finally, social distancing is such an artificial construct, isn't it, for humans? I mean, we're social animals, and I'm probably not alone in having found the social distancing personally very awkward. When I'm going, for example, to our distribution centres and our warehouses to see for myself the safety measures that we're instituting, just staying 2 metres away from everyone just goes against the grain for us. So I think it is here to stay for a while. Business would be well advised to cater for it. In fact, it's essential that we do, because it's essential to just consolidate the public health gains that we've seen. But I certainly won't miss it when it's gone.
Amber, has politics changed for good, or will it just go back to its old ways again?
I certainly think this government has changed in that it can now basically reset, move away from the manifesto, and the whole talk in the past about trying to limiting spending on things like social care, on the NHS, on infrastructure, that is over. I think this will be a big opportunity for a big spend, and that will yield different results entirely, which will be impossible to see. But just my final hope is that in that investment, which is surely coming, that we do think about the planet and we think about climate change, and we do actually use that opportunity to green it in a way that we hadn't before.
Francis, you must hope that there's a reset between relations between unions and managers and businesses.
I hope so, and I hope we've all learned some lessons. I mean, you know, flexible working, let's be positive about it. Why not make our presumption that people can work flexibly rather than it being a special request? What about meaningful work? I mean, look at the way the post is and firefighters all volunteer to take on a community role in their jobs. People want to feel like they're doing a good job at work and that it's helping their communities. Maybe we can keep some of that spirit. And I'm glad to hear Amber's optimism that maybe we've learned some lessons on the price that we've paid for the false economy of cutting our public services and welfare systems, which looked pretty ragged when the crisis first hit and have struggled to keep up. But just finally, where are we on trade agreements? They seem to have stalled, and that to me seems a pretty fundamental priority for the Prime Minister. If we're going to get the country back on its feet, then we better get some trade agreements signed.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm just going to bring it to a close now. I want to say, I hope you all agree, we've had a really stellar panel this week and they've really been fascinating. I would like to give the sort of traditional virtual round of applause that they can all imagine and thank them for their help. So Alex Baldock, Amber Rudd, Nicola Mendelsohn and Francis O'Grady, thank you very much. Stay safe and stay well, and we'll do it all again next week. Thank you very much. Yeah.